Thank you. I thank the organizers for inviting you here today. And it was an entomologist that got me involved in these projects to start with. And of course, now he's retired, and I haven't been smart enough to get out of these yet. So he's not here, and I am. when we want to look at the maintaining a sustainable agroecosystem, we need to consider all the interactions involved, including the environmental factors in crop production and management interacting with the microbial community structure and function beneath the ground, because this is where the action is. These interactions here control most of the nutrient transformations that make nutrients plant available. So it's important to look at what potential entry of foreign substances into the soil might have an effect on those. So if you look at a schematic, and we've talked a lot about this, or it's already been discussed already about the exudation from roots into the soil. But when we put a transgenic crop into the picture, we also not only have transgenic proteins possibly coming in there, but then if you have a transgenic herbicide-resistant crop, you have other components that sometimes we don't think about that are also entering the soil. And so with all the carbon that's being released from these roots, recall that probably about upwards of 50% of the photosynthate in plants can be released into soil through rhizodeposition. I think our friends here from Iowa realize that with those nice black mollisols that were developed from thousands of years of prairie vegetation. So these substances are added to the carbon pool which the microorganisms encounter. Just a close-up of the rhizosphere showing that a lot of the action is in here compared to bulk soil. In fact, much of the enzymes and microbial activity moves away from the rhizosphere into the bulk soil. In this case, it's acquiring phosphorus, but this is applicable to other nutrient transformations as well, such as sulfur and some of the micronutrients, including iron and manganese. Now, we've been looking at transgenic crops since they've come out in commercial use for over 10 years. We looked at some transgenic BT transformed corn, and a lot of our studies have shown that, and including those that have some lignin in them, because it is a concern, as was pointed out earlier. For instance, this was a study we conducted over one or two rowing seasons, and we were looking at nitrogen mineralization in the soil, and we saw that there was no effect. Now we didn't try to isolate effects due to the transgenic proteins that were being released into the soil. We're just looking at it from the standpoint of genetically modified versus conventional or non-modified crops. In this particular study, we did not see any difference. Nearly the same is true with another study where we look at carbon transformations, again looking at a hybrid, BT hybrid and its isoline, looking at carbon mineralization. Now, we did see some transient differences in the early part of the season here, but as the season went on, those differences did not persist, and this seems to be a theme in some studies where there is this function of soil resilience, where the soil over time will overcome whatever problem or that the substance gives, and will go back to the natural state. So the general activity of carbon mineralization was not affected. There were some specific activities, however, might be affected, and so this may need further study. When we looked at the molecular analysis with four different corn varieties, two that were that were genetically modified for BT resistant or BT transformed, and the non-transgenic varieties, we see that there was not a whole lot of difference in the batting patterns across the four corn hybrids. But if you look at the three different soils, the banding patterns were greater that way. Considerably greater difference between the soils than there was between the corn hybrids within the soils. And indeed, when you do the stats on banding patterns, look at a cluster analysis with N meaning non-BT and T meaning transgenic, the similarities were fairly close within the soils between those different hybrids. The greater dissimilarity was with the soils again. And when we did a physiological profile using Biolog, which some of you I think are familiar with it, which exposes the soil population to a battery of different carbon sources, again we see the same thing when you do a principal component analysis such as you see here. Primarily the sand soil separated out from everything else, but the other soil stayed together regardless of whether we had a transgenic or non-transgenic variety. So this is a conclusion for the first part of these studies, were that we thought that these general community type analysis were suitable techniques for monitoring these diverse microbial communities. The diversity patterns before plant growth did differ without the corn plant in it, but as the season went on, the varieties did not generate obvious changes in the soil microbial communities, as was our hypothesis. And as you can see from the statistics that we showed you, the soil texture did have a significant impact on bacterial diversity patterns, and this is something that's been shown before in the literature. So when we see these microbial shifts, and these are often under control, I guess I should say when microbial shifts are observed that are reported in the literature, these are often observed under controlled studies. And some of these are included in studies such as the BT transformed tree seedling, some of the spruces that are used in timber plantations, genetically modified tobacco for photosynthesis, show microbial shifts. So how do you interpret these? So it's been suggested that perhaps we should be looking more at functional genes to detect an impact on the functional diversity rather than using the primers as we did for basically taxonomic diversity, which shows you differences in the community structure. Also, it's been noted that sample timing during the season, plant age, management, whether it's continuous cropping or crop rotation, does affect the consistency and the persistence of any effect that we may see with these transgenic crops. So we've been looking at a polyphasic approach for microbial ecology and a more thorough analysis of transgenic crop impacts. And this is because the complexity of the rhizosphere often challenges us to devise an appropriate framework that effectively evaluates these genetically modified crops. And so the use of indicator groups and specific microbial activities that may be sensitive to ecosystem changes and relevant to the particular transgenic system in place is proposed, and this has been shown before that polyphasic microbial analysis would target a broader impact, and a multiple analysis in addition to the molecular and the physiological profiles may give a more reliable view. So based on these guidelines for assessing responses of soil microorganisms were developed by these authors here. And so this is kind of a pictorial of what I'm getting to, is that as we can see, much of the, say, biomass, microbial activities through carbon respiration, general molecular profiling, sometimes it's difficult to demonstrate an effect, an impact. But when you get a little bit more specific with specific microbial groups, maybe the metagenome using the specific functional genes may give a little more information, maybe more sensitive to ecosystem alteration by these genetically modified crops. Now, even though some of these are based on cultural techniques, I contend that as long as you're looking at a very select group and you're using a selective technique to tease these out of the soil, that information still reveals some important information. One of the things that we found looking at some of these microorganisms on the rhizoplane or the root surface is that we're beginning to see development of biofilms on transgenic soybeans. Now, what this means, not real sure yet, we're just getting into it, but a lot of these bacteria have been keyed out as agrobacterium, which produce a lot of exopolysaccharide to form these layers. What's interesting with agrobacterium is that they are very intense manganese oxidizers, which have been shown in other environments to occur in these biofilms. This might be a situation where manganese may be made unavailable to plants due to their proliferation on the rhizoplane. Another group we're looking at are fluorescent pseudomonads, which have very many beneficial properties. And when we look at some of the, for instance, the non-transgenic variety here, Williams 82, has a different profile of these types of bacteria compared to a glyphosate-resistant cultivar that you can see here. That's with just a tank mix herbicide. When you use a glyphosate, we get a different pattern. The Williams 82 is fairly consistent with the tank mix, or whether it's hand weeded here. So it seems like this may be an alteration. Again, this is quite preliminary information. Does the transgenic plant in combination with glyphosate alter this component in the rhizosphere? What does it mean when it affects this composition? I think there's a lot that could happen here. Remember, pseudomonads produce a lot of plant growth regulators. They're antagonistic to plant pathogens. Many important characteristics. So I'd like to go into just a little bit of some of the glyphosate-resistant transgenic crop soybean work that we've been doing, and I hope it doesn't duplicate any information that will be coming in the next talk by Carrie. But one of the things that, if you remember the first couple of slides that I showed you, another component that is added with these transgenic crops is the actual herbicide that is applied to these glyphosate-resistant crops. And because the herbicide is systemic, it often finds its way to the roots and released into the soil, into the rhizosphere. One of the studies that we did with hydroponics demonstrated this. We have Williams 82, again, the non-transgenic herbicide, glyphosate-susceptible plant, plus a glyphosate-resistant, I can't remember if it was a Pioneer or DeKalb, but it's in the paper, and I'd be glad to send all this information to you. What we see is that after application of glyphosate is released into the hydroponic system over time by both plants. Obviously, Williams eventually dies, and we get this plateau here. With the glyphosate-resistant cultivar, we have a continuous release of glyphosate into the rhizosphere over time. Now, the interesting thing is that oftentimes you'll see in the literature that people are reporting unintended effects of genetic modification. And I'm not sure if this is what we found here, but it was interesting to look at the carbohydrates that were released in the hydroponic experiment. With the glyphosate-resistant cultivar, we had a considerable release of carbohydrates, whether the glyphosate was applied, as this line here is, or whether glyphosate was not applied over time, compared to the Williams cultivar, where we had considerably less release of carbohydrates into the rhizosphere. So we don't know if that was a particularly leaky root system, or if it was due to an unintended effect of genetic modification. I did not have the isoline, that it may have been similar, so that's the only drawback to that particular study. What we see with glyphosate-resistant soybean is that we get a considerable colonization of the root system with fusarium, and we've seen this since 1997. We get quite a bit more in the presence of glyphosate compared to those without herbicides, and this has been consistent for the past 10 or so years. Is that an effect due to the carbohydrate release? Is it an effect due to glyphosate having some effect on the plant? We show that some strains of fusarium will actually metabolize and sporulate in the presence of glyphosate. So there's a lot of things going on in the soil. And this is just an example with a particular corn variety that had both BT engineered BT toxin production and glyphosate resistance, that the fusarium colonization of roots increases over time. This is just for a short time, 20 days after application. Now we're looking at these specific indicators. We're beginning to see some interactions here. This is fusarium root colonization with the Pseudomonas that we showed earlier. We're getting as pseudomonads decrease, a fusarium increase, it indicates that maybe there's some antagonistic relationships that are being overcome there when we lose the fusarium. There is some scattered work done on mycorrhizae with the transgenic crops. It's often inconsistent because many factors confound the potential effects of transgenic plants on mycorrhizae. That can be the level of inorganic phosphorus in the soil, the crop variety, and even the other rhizosphere microbial community members. It is interesting, one report, that within BT corn varieties there may be variability just based on the amount of the BT toxin that is being released or the rate at which it's being released into the soil. There is a report that the one with the higher expression of the cryotoxin reduced mycorrhizal development and infection compared with a similar BT corn, but it just didn't produce as much or release as much toxin into the soil. So I think there's a lot of work that can be done with that yet. We're just looking a little bit at it on soybean, and when we see decreases in mycorrhizae on the soybean, it's mainly after two or three applications of glyphosate. Usually with one application, you don't see it. So in this big schematic, and this doesn't have to be restricted to glyphosate, it can be applied to most any crop or any transgenetic modification. There's a lot of activity going on. We may have high carbohydrate release. There are other things, plus the transgenic toxin being released. It may select for these populations, which we think are going on with fusarium and soybean. It may, supposedly there are some situations where fusarium may compete for the carbohydrate and reduce the populations of bacteria in the rhizosphere. Mycorrhizal interactions, and we haven't even talked about nodulation by rhizobium. There are some interactions there. So the complexity here is very much confounded with the different genetic modifications. So in conclusion then, a critical evaluation of the effects of these crops and release of transgenic proteins on soil and rhizosphere microorganisms really depends on standard and reproducible methods. Molecular methods are important for monitoring complex communities, and I think it's really given us a whole new insight of what's going on in there because, as was pointed out previously, the amount of the communities that are not culturable. However, parallel methods for assessing functional diversity should be included. This is where the polyphasic approach comes in. And for future biomonitoring, we should be considering use of these functional genes, perhaps through the application of microarray analysis. So with that, that's it.
We have time for one question. Anyone have a question?
Yes.
By any chance, do you have detected the difference between the microalgae using molecular testing?
The question was whether there have been any detection in differences in mycorrhizae using molecular techniques. We have not done it, but I think there is some work out there using specific probes for Vlomis or whatever genus they may have. Thanks.
Thank you.